And I think we can all see the truth in what he is saying as we come to Genesis chapter 27. I may have plagiarized the title to the message, I think, as you have it, is actually the title to a sort of a country western song, which I have not heard for a while. But the song was, Working Like the Devil, Serving the Lord. And that is just about what happens. I had so many things in my mind. One of them would go something like this, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the biggest sinner of them all? And I think if there was a real mirror who could respond, he would simply shrug his shoulders and say, I don't know, they're all in it pretty deep so far as I can tell. And that is true. You see in this chapter, and it's really a tragic thing, that here is a family unit, and there is politicking and scheming going on that literally divides the family in half. And it is one of the great tragedies of marriage and family life, and certainly a warning to us. Well, let's take a look at how things work out. There is a conspiracy, then a counter-conspiracy, and it is a rather awesome story that gives us many warnings about our own family and Christian experience. The first is the conspiracy of Isaac and Esau, as it's described in verses 1 through 4. I have several words that, to me, sort of capsulize the mood that I think is behind these verses. And the first mood might be that of urgency. There is, as I understand it, a sense of urgency, a sense of immediacy, a sense of imminency that is behind this. Isaac seems to appear as a man who has one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel. And whatever he doest, he must do quickly. He thinks. Urgency. And I might simply say the doctrine of imminence may be a biblical doctrine, but it oftentimes has unbiblical side effects. And many times the things that we do out of a sense of immediacy may be the wrong things. And that is precisely what happens in Isaac's life. If we do a little mental calculating, we will discover, or at least we will come close, I think, to his age at age 137. Now, that number probably had a familiar ring to Isaac, and, well, it should have, because about 14 years earlier, his brother, Ishmael, had died at age 137. And perhaps that is part of what is motivating Isaac and giving him that sense of urgency. Also, you will notice that he is suffering from the maladies of older age. All of us may be able to identify. His eyes were too dim to see. And while we have cataract surgery and other things that can be done in these days and corrective lenses, he did not. And therefore, it is undoubtedly so that he suffered these maladies, but he understood them, he interpreted them in such a way that he thought that death's door was very, very close at hand. Or at least he convinced himself of such. The irony of it is this. He was a little off on his timing. If he was crawling into his deathbed, he was about 40 years too soon. You see, in Genesis, we discover in chapter 35 and verse 28 that he died at 180. Well, if I add right, that means he had a good 40 years left to go. Well, there was a sense of immediacy, he thought. There is also a mood of secrecy. And you get the feeling of that, especially as you look later on and you see Jacob blessing his sons. There he calls all of his sons together around his bedside. And remember it says that he drew up his feet into the bed and he breathed his last. But obviously in that setting, and I think in the average setting of the blessing, it was a very public affair. And there was good reason for that. The blessing was an oral will. And obviously you would want to have as many witnesses as possible there to verify the arrangements that had been made for the disposition of property and so on. But here there is a very clear atmosphere of secrecy. You will notice that this affair was going to involve Isaac and his son Esau. not Rebekah and her son, Jacob. Strange that it should be so secret, but so it was. There is the mood also of what I call conspiracy. And I think you can see rather evident in these verses, Isaac is endeavoring to overturn, to twist, to manipulate the clear purpose of God, and that was that the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant were going to pass not through Esau, the oldest son, but through Jacob, the younger son. That we have already seen. Now, some might question whether or not Isaac knew of that revelation from God. Well, I would say this. Although we are not told specifically, our knowledge of human nature should let us know with full confidence that he knew for this reason. There was a power struggle going on. It was a struggle essentially between Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And it involved those two sons, each of whom had an alliance with a parent. And I am sure that there were many discussions that took place, and surely Rebekah, as any of us, not just as a woman, but any person with an Adamic nature, when pressed to the wall, I am sure that she would have said, "Now, Isaac, it is right what I am doing because God said so." Surely she would have pulled that out as the ace from up her sleeve to drop that on Isaac to verify or to give validity to her prejudicial treatment of her son. If God were on your side and there was a dispute, you would let people know that God was too. So that I am sure that that was evident. In addition to that, there is the evidence of the sale of the birthright. And you will notice that Esau gives evidence of that to his father. He says, "He has deceived me these two times. The first time he took my birthright." And Isaac does not say, "Oh, you never told me about that." It was common evidence, common knowledge, I believe. If that is not enough, there is verses 34 and 35 of chapter 26. And there we see that Esau has already manifested his character, not only in the sale of the birthright, but now in taking two Hittite wives. So he has demonstrated that he is unfit. He has no regard for maintaining racial purity, which was essential to the Abrahamic covenant being fulfilled. And yet, in light of all of these facts, Isaac has set his course directly in disobedience to what God had said. That, to me, is conspiracy. And I think that Isaac felt that if he only did the right things in the right way, he could manipulate the purpose of God. Now, I think we need to understand the relationship between the birthright and the blessing. As I understand the birthright, it not only entitles the oldest son to a double portion of the property, but it also gives that oldest son the spiritual heritage and the headship over the family or the clan. Zondervan's pictorial encyclopedia of the Bible says this: "The birthright was more than a title to the family inheritance. It involved a spiritual position. The place of the individual in the covenant status of Israel was part of the birthright, and it was this aspect which made the foolishness of Esau so profound." And that means that Esau had already been excluded from the right to be the heir and the head of the family. And yet, Isaac intended to go ahead and do it anyway. Now, I think this is how he was going to do it. If you notice that Genesis chapter 48 and also Genesis chapter 49, the blessing was what took place usually at the deathbed, shortly before death. And as I have said, it wasn't quite that setting that we see here because Isaac was anxious to get the process over and done with, to do the dirty deed and have it done. And he felt like perhaps 137 was late enough to do that. So that what Isaac had set out to do was to overturn the natural trend of events by the oral will. Now, as I said, there was no written will in those days. It was an oral testimony that was given at the time of blessing. In Genesis 48, Jacob, when his two grandsons are brought to him by Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, or I should say Manasseh and Ephraim, in that order. You remember that Jacob crossed his hands, much to the chagrin of Joseph. He thought that his father was really old and senile, and he tried to switch them around, and Jacob manifested that he was deliberately changing the precedence of the older son over the younger, and it was the younger who would have the preeminence over the older. And then in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob is blessing the sons, you remember that he takes Reuben, who is the oldest, and he removes the preeminence from Reuben because of the specific sin that he had committed. Now, all of that means this to me. It means that while the natural order of events would be determined through the birthright, and that birthright, even in the contemporary society, could be sold, that the last-ditch opportunity of the father to change that was what he did in the expression of his will in the blessing. And so Isaac perceives that if he can only manage this blessing, he can change matters back. He can reverse the order that had been established by the sale of the birthright, and he can therefore overturn the judgment of God, and he can get his own way. It is a clear attempt to manipulate the will of God in his life and for his sons. Some would say, how could a spiritual man ever do that? I like what Leupold said about that. He says, he that knows the duplicity and the treachery of the human heart will not find it difficult to understand how a man will circumvent a word of God, no matter how clear it be, if his heart is really set on what is at variance with that word. All of us, I think, have the innate ability to identify with Isaac. And that is, when we really determine we're going to do something, it doesn't matter what God says. It only matters what we want to do. There is also the note of folly, I think, and that is that while he is bent upon changing the will of God, he is set upon a course of folly that will surely not be fruitful. Now, let's look at the counterplot in verses 5 through 17. Here is the counter-conspiracy. Rebekah is on the scene, and Jacob, her son, is involved. As I have said, I see the contest as a contest primarily between Isaac and his wife Rebekah, not a contest primarily between Jacob and his brother Esau. And the children are the pawns. Verse 5, you will notice that Esau is called his son. And verse 6, Jacob is called her son. There had been a clear cleavage, and there was a power structure that had developed. Isaac as opposed to Rebekah, and Isaac and Esau as opposed to Rebekah and Jacob. We saw that at the birth and the description of the birth, there was a clear alliance of one parent expressing a preference for a son over the other parent's preference for the other. Also, you will notice that, now this is reading between the lines, so put little quotation marks or something around this, but I sense that the conspiracy that we see is not some spur of the moment thought. I just cannot see that. Rebekah was too good at what she did. She was very good. You'll notice the last verse of chapter 27. Rebekah has already concluded Jacob has got to move out for a while. But she does not come to Isaac as Sarah would have. Sarah was an interesting woman. As I see her personality, she was just flat out. She'd have gone to Isaac and said, send my son Jacob down there and do it now. That's Sarah. But Rebekah is a schemer, and she will not do that, but she manipulates as beautifully as Sarah dictates. She goes and she said, oh, I'm so depressed. These Hittite women. Why, if my boy Jacob marries one Hittite, I just don't want to live. And so she hasn't told him what to do. She hasn't said one word of instruction. But it doesn't take Jacob or Isaac much intelligence to figure out we got to send Jacob down to the relatives. That's what she had already told. She'd already said. Rebekah had said to Jacob, pack your bag, son. You're going to go. She had it all set up. She was a schemer. All right. So I think that she had this beautiful plot all worked out. You will notice that Jacob, although he is a schemer, he doesn't hold a candle to his mother. She had all the details worked out. You know, Jacob, when she lays out this plan before him, Jacob has two objections. The first objection is it won't work. Not it's not right, it won't work. It's too hard. Mission impossible. And she says to him, in effect, I thought it all out. It'll work. Now, do you think she just happened to have goat skins laying around? Do you really believe that? Do you believe that she just happened to grab a goat skin and wrap it around his neck and that he held it with his hand and tried to hold one other goat skin like this and one other goat skin like this? No way. Do you think she had time to sew those goat skins between the time that Isaac or Esau had gone out to kill himself a deer and to fix it and the time that the blessing had to be given? No way. And notice in verse 5 it says, and Rebekah was listening at the door. Rebekah could have worked for the CIA. She was shrewd. It wasn't she just happened to be standing by the door. She always stood by the door and she always had her ear pitched to what happened in that room. Listen, she knew that Isaac was up to something with Esau and it was only a matter of time. So she had her ear pinned to the wall. She always listened to what was going on, and you bet she heard what was happening. But when the golden moment of opportunity came, I think she had all the props in place. And she simply brings her son and says, go out and get that. I've already got these things. I think they were custom tailored, all of those things, the goat skins and all of that. It seems to me that this is not a quick matter. Let me say one other thing. What should Rebekah have done? What should Rebekah have done other than what she did do? Well, I think she should have been a godly wife. And I think with a submissive attitude, she should have climbed all over Isaac. I think she should have rebuked him. Nowhere does the scripture say that someone who is in submission to someone else ought not to rebuke them. That ought to be done in the right way. An elder, it says, ought to be rebuked on the witnesses, two or more witnesses. Don't do it if you haven't got good evidence. But if it has to be done, do it. And by the way, it says in 1 Timothy, do it publicly. An elder's a public figure. His sin is public. The correction must be public. To be in submission to someone does not mean you do not correct them or rebuke them. I think she should have laid her case before her husband and said, you know that God has said Jacob will rule over Esau. You know that is what's right. And now you are attempting to overturn that. But I'm going to leave it with God. That is what she did not do. I like the advice that Gideon's father gave to those who wanted to kill Gideon after he had torn down the altar to Baal. Here is the advice that I think perhaps Rebekah should have taken. Gideon's father says, will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? If he is God, let him contend for himself. And that's my advice to Rebekah as the fifth quarterback. That's what I would have said to Rebekah. That's what we would have to say to ourselves. If God is God, if God has said the elder shall serve the younger, let God be God. You don't have to scheme and connive in order for God's will to be done. God is sovereign, and it will be done. And we do not have to sin in order for that to be achieved. Okay, I'll notice also the debate. Jacob does debate with his mother a bit, but as I've already said, he debates on two issues. One, it can't be done. Well, she's planned too well for that to pass. She already has it all laid out. The second area of the debate is, but what happens if we fail? Now, I want you to notice that. The issue is not morality. It is consequence. He says, if my father feels me and discovers that I have deceived him, I don't like the word deceiver as it's translated here in verse 12, it, as it literally is in the margin, it should be mocker. You see, if at any point in this deceptive plot, Isaac comes to his senses and says, you're Jacob. You're Jacob, aren't you? What he would then see of his son is not just you tried to deceive me, you mocked me. You took me for an old fool. He was. You mocked me. You thought I was so daffy that I would fall for you as my son. See, that is making fun of an old man. That is mockery. And he says, it'll bring a curse on me. Verse 12. That's why I shouldn't do it, because if I lose, I'm in trouble. I noticed back in 1 Timothy chapter 1, Paul says the law is not really for the righteous. It's for the unrighteous. And the reason is, the unrighteous really are restrained from doing evil, not because it's evil, but because it doesn't pay. Now, we say crime doesn't pay. Every criminal knows it does. I talked to one fellow and he said, listen, I could go knock off one coin machine and I can make more in 20 minutes than I can make in a day. It does pay. And that's the mentality. Don't look at the morality of the issue. Look at the consequences. Let me give you an illustration in 20th century terms. Sexual morality. We don't talk about whether it's right or wrong anymore. We talk about venereal disease. We talk about pregnancy. And modern day science has given us the answer. Penicillin, the pill, and abortion. Nobody talks about whether it's right or wrong. All people say is, well, what if I get sick? Or what if I get pregnant? Society offers those solutions, and everybody says, well, it's all right. See, that's the mentality of only looking at consequence. And that's what I have wrong. This is an incidental parenthesis. That's what I have against sex education in schools that is taught by godless people. All they will do is tell you how to avoid disease, how to avoid pregnancy. They won't talk to you about what's right and what's wrong. And that, to me, is the symptom of a sick relationship, and that is the way it was with Rebecca and her son, Jacob. You will notice that the way that she talks him into this is not to say, well, it's really right. It's really right what we're doing. But she says, if it all blows up, I'll take the blame. And that's all it took for Jacob, just so the consequences weren't there for sin. Now, I want you to know that she did take a lot of the consequence, but Jacob shared it. All right, so there is that whole mentality of consequence as opposed to principle. Now, look at what happens in verses 18 through 29. Here he comes with the meal that has been prepared, and I call this, I retitled it, Jacob Believes the Big Lie. As Hitler used to believe, little lies are often perceived, but big lies are so big people can't believe you would try to put it over on them. And so if you're going to lie, lie big. And I'm telling you, Jacob was the man for the hour. If he knew how to do anything, it was to lie big. Notice how his lie grows. First of all, you will notice in verse 19, he says, I am Esau, your firstborn, lie one. Then he goes on in the same verse and he says, I have done as you told me, lie two. He had not gone out with his bow and arrow and shot a deer. He'd gone out to the goat shed and grabbed a couple of kids and drug them in. He hadn't done it as his father had said. And thirdly, he says, eat of my game. That wasn't game, it was a goat. He was expecting venison. He got goat meat. That was a lie too. And then in verse 24, Isaac is still nervous about this. Something doesn't register, in particular the voice. And so he says, are you really my son Esau? And Jacob says, I am. But the crowning event comes in verse 20. His father says to him, how is it, my son, that you've done this so quickly? And when all else fails, we can always make God a partner in our sin. That is the way of sanctifying unbelief and disobedience. Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. Now, I must confess that that is the point at which I expect the ceiling to fall in, for the lightning to come blapping down and God just to crash in. And yet that's what you and I do all the time. The Lord spoke to me and said thus and so. Well, the Lord led me to do this. The Lord provided this particular thing. Now, what we mean is, I felt like it, I've always wanted it, and I finally got it, whether it was wise or not. But it really sounds better if somehow God is our partner. And that is precisely what Jacob does. So let's be careful when we come down on Jacob. Let's think about our own pious phraseology, which really means I did just exactly what I wanted to do. Notice the vulnerability of Isaac. He is vulnerable because of his age. He doesn't see well. It seems he doesn't think well. His age was no doubt a problem, but I think the great problem was his depravity. I say that because we are depraved as well. See, the doctrine of total depravity doesn't mean a man is 100% rotten. It means that 100% of his being has been tainted by sin. And most Christians, I think, believe that the only thing that's been affected by sin is our emotions, but that our intellect is still right on course. But I want to tell you, Isaac's intellect wasn't doing too well. And do you notice that all five of his senses, all five senses are used? His sight, his hearing, his feel. And you know what finally clinches it? His smell. He was led by his nose, literally. He had asked all these questions. I like the way J. Vernon McGee says it. You know, I don't know what happened. But there was still this lingering question. Is this really my son? Well, you remember Rebecca had just incidentally happened to have one of Esau's best suits. She probably told him she was going to mend it or press it. And she'd been saving it for this moment. And so as he comes near to be kissed, there are two ways of translating that in experience. Some would say that Isaac leans near to kiss him and he goes, and it's like he was wearing denim. You know, that new denim aftershave lotion? The smell of my son. J. Vernon McGee is a little more earthy. And he says that he comes close to kiss him and he goes, that's my son! It wasn't his brand of deodorant. He didn't wear any. And that's why he says, yep, smells like a field. Smells like the barnyard. I don't know. But whatever it was, that was the clincher. His nose. That was what settled it. And that leads me to say this. We live in a scientific age, and people are saying to us, you know, the only thing that can really be trusted is the empirical data. We can only trust that which we can smell, which we can see, which we can hear, which we can touch. Isn't it interesting that all five senses were employed? And because of his depravity, they all led him in the wrong direction. That is not to play down the empirical evidence. It is simply to say that empirical evidence that is employed by a man who has already made up his mind will not lead him to the truth. It will lead him to do what he always wanted to do anyway. His vulnerability. Well, there's some poetic justice, and we could talk about this, but I think that's very interesting, the sort of the poetic justice of the whole thing, how God deals ironically. For example, in the blessing, you will notice, in the blessing that Isaac gives, it is the blessing which is deliberately intended to take all the blessings and give them to Esau, and none of the blessings are left for Isaac. The poetic justice is that it turns upside down. And so his son Esau says to him, have you no blessing for me, my father? You see, if his father had dealt with him in fairness, then his father could have said, well, yes, my son, I do. I have the blessing which I had saved for your brother Jacob. He didn't have a blessing for Jacob. He didn't plan to give Jacob anything. So then in verse 29, the pronouncement of the blessing, he says, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. You see, the full intent of this blessing was to pass the Abrahamic covenant and its promises through Esau, he thought, rather than through Jacob, as God had ordained. Now, I call this next section, you'll have to pardon me, I have called this, Isaac Learns and Esau Burns, Genesis 27, verses 30 through 40. You talk about red man. Boy, he was really red when it came to this particular event. And you notice the irony? Esau sold his birthright on the occasion of a meal. And isn't it interesting that his father is conned out of the blessing over a meal as well? I'm afraid that Isaac and his son Esau were very much alike. And that is perhaps why Isaac found it so difficult to rebuke his son for the very tendencies that he himself had. Now, the drama of the event, I think, is there. If we could only see it. I mean, it must have been comical. This old man trying to determine whether this was his son or not. But can you imagine Jacob walking in? I would like to think that Jacob was a small kind of guy, not muscular at all, and that Esau was a great big football player that could have played guard or tackle. And so in walks Jacob dressed in this garb. It must have been a comedy. His father was so daffy he couldn't recognize it. And of course, his vision was blurred. But I mean, here he comes in and the robe is just trailing off behind him and draping over his shoulder. These goat skins are tied to him and around his neck. It must have been just humor. And yet, there was a sense of urgency because he knew he had to go in, get the meal over with, get the blessing, and get out before Esau came. And if Esau came before the blessing was given, he was really in trouble, and he knew that. So there's a sense of drama that builds up. And you'll notice that it says that Jacob just barely gets out before Esau comes in. And then you can see the turn of events. Esau comes in thinking that he and his dad are really putting one over. I mean, he comes in, he went and he got the venison, he made the stew. He's right on the moment of victory. It's just within his grasp. And he comes in with a meal, and his father is sitting up in his bed, smiling to himself, thinking, I finally got one over on Rebekah. And to his shock, his son comes in and says, Father, it's time to eat. Sit up. Eat. Again? Who are you? And then his father begins to tremble and shake as he recognizes that he's been taken. And then Esau, who's a couple of steps behind, begins to recognize that he's finished. There is that drama that I think permeates the entire account. And it really is a tragic event. The consequences, I think, for Isaac and for Esau are spelled out more in verses 30 through 40 than they are in the final concluding verses. The consequence for Esau was that he despised spiritual things. And God set that decision in cement, and it was irreversible. He was sorry, but it was too late. And I would simply say that regret does not restore. Our kids say it all the time. A child will do something foolishly, and they will hit one of the kids or do something, and then the kid's all bloody, and the crying and the tears goes on, and they say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I go to say to them, sorry doesn't make them better. And that's what you have to say to Esau. He's sorry, he regrets it, but regret doesn't restore. It is too late. He has despised spiritual things, and now his course is set in concrete. Isaac, his father, was one who thought of himself as a schemer. He thought he could manipulate God. But God's dealing with Isaac was to give him a wife who was better at what he did than he was. And she manipulated him. So that Isaac now has to live out, and although he had tried to hoard all of the blessings and put them upon his favorite son Esau, he had now nothing to give to Esau that he had given that blessing intended for Esau to Jacob. So the consequences are clear, I think, for both Jacob and his son Esau. The consequences for Rebekah and for Jacob are more spelled out in verses 41 through 46. And let me simply suggest some of those. Rebekah was one who really was a schemer. I mean, she was good. But her problem was that she favored one son. She used divine revelation to substantiate that prejudice, which really was ill-founded. And then she felt that although God, she believed in God, she had faith in God, she believed that those promised blessings would be true, but her God was not sufficient to bring about those blessings unless there was deceit and deception on her part. She did not think that God was greater than the schemes of her husband Isaac. And interestingly enough, all that she fought for her son to gain, he really lost. And think of the separation that comes in here. The separation between Jacob and Esau, the separation between Jacob and his father, and perhaps most striking, the separation that must have occurred between Isaac and Rebekah, who had chosen her son over her husband. But the crowning blow was the fact that while she did this for her son, whom she deeply loved, it cost her her son. And she then, as a result of the sin and of the anger and the animosity of Esau, she had to send her son away. And so far as Revelation is concerned, she never saw him again. I want to tell you, the price was high. And none of the benefits which she hoped for, she enjoyed. Jacob was the schemer. Jacob was the one who was willing to achieve godly goals through any means. He experienced the division from his brother and his animosity. He experienced the separation from his mother, who he deeply loved. But just as God had dealt with Isaac by giving him a wife who was swifter than he, God dealt with Jacob by giving him an uncle who was shrewder than he was. And all that Jacob had connived to get, and now he had the supremacy and the double portion, all of that he had to leave behind. He couldn't take it, and he couldn't enjoy it. So that all of the sins and all of the devices have not brought what these individuals expected or hoped for. Instead, it has brought division, disunity, hatred, negative results. Now let me suggest some of the doctrines that I think are contained in this portion of Scripture. One of them is the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. And I have come to be reassured of this truth. The sinfulness of man will never frustrate the purposes of God, although it will fulfill the purposes of God. Man's sin can never keep God from doing what he intends to do. Although the irony of it is that God can employ that sin to bring about precisely what he intended to do. That is the case here. Some may then say, well, then is God responsible for sin? Does God make it happen? No, God in his sovereignty employs that sin to bring about his result. But it is not any negative. It has no negative connotation on God because God did not make it happen, and the result did not have to happen by means of sin. God always has a righteous way of achieving his purposes. Let me suggest what would have happened then. What could have happened? People always ask this. What would have happened if Jesus hadn't been crucified? What would have happened if Jesus would have been accepted as Messiah? I don't know, but let me make a couple of suggestions about this. What would have happened had Rebekah and Jacob not connived to outwit their father and his brother? First of all, you'll notice that in this blessing that Isaac gives, he says, may God give you of the dew of heaven, may peoples serve you, and may your mother's son bow down to you. See, I think that Isaac really looked at this blessing as a magical formula, just like some of us look at the prayer, and we read in the Scriptures that if any two of you are agreed on anything on earth, it'll be done. That's a magic formula. And so we plug it in and we crank it out and we think God's got to do exactly what we want. That's magic, not Christianity. I think that was Isaac's mentality, but in the words that he spoke, he was theologically accurate, and that is, blessing never comes from men. It comes from God. And the very words that he spoke were an expression that blessing and cursing is that which only God can bring to pass. And as the proverb says, a curse that is without basis flies away like it has wings. Let me give you another illustration. In Numbers chapters 22 through 24, the Israelites are entering into the promised land. And Balak begins to panic, because he knows all the victories that the Israelites have had. And he says to himself, if only I can get a prophet that will curse these people, they're finished. So you remember he hired Balaam. And every time Balaam opened his mouth to curse Israel, he blessed them. It is impossible for anyone to curse whom God has blessed. It is impossible. And I would like to submit to you that had Rebekah and Jacob not been involved in this scheme and this plot, Isaac could never have spoken this blessing over his son, Esau. Never. But that was their deception. The sovereignty of God. There is also the doctrine of human depravity, is there not? And it is evident here. Sin separates. That is one of the things that we learn throughout Scripture. Sin has brought division into a family. It has separated husband and wife, son from son, and children from parents. Sin always separates. And it is not accidental that Jacob must leave because of his sin. Now, let me suggest a couple of other things before we close that I think are very significant in this passage. One is that it is very possible for Christians to become so preoccupied about the goals that God has that we think any means are appropriate to reach them. I think that is very, very common in Christianity. I think, for example, that we look at the goal of the salvation of men as so valuable that we are willing to compromise the gospel. We are willing to Madison Avenue the gospel, to put out all of the fine print, to play down all of the negatives of the Christian life, that we are willing to deceive people into accepting Jesus Christ because the end is so good. And I want to say to you, that's wrong. That tells me something about God. Many Christians are frustrated because God only leads us a step at a time. That God does not tell us what the ultimate ends are. You know why He doesn't? Because if God told us exactly what His ultimate ends are, we'd cheat all the way to them. We would. See, God is more concerned about righteousness than He is about success. We are more concerned about success than we are righteousness. And God says it's more important how you get there than just getting there. One other thing. This passage informs me that while an act may be done out of faith, the act itself may be inconsistent with faith. Look at Hebrews chapter 11. Whew! I read this, and boy, it really makes you scratch your head. After you've read the account in Genesis, you come to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 20, and look what it says. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. Now, would you have written that? Would you have read Genesis and written that? You know what it says? The author of the Hebrews is saying, believe it or not, Wrigley's style, believe it or not, what Isaac did was out of faith. But you know what, out of, stemming from, faith. His faith was that there was a promise and that there was a God who was faithful to His promise. And therefore, it was all important that those promises go to whom he thought they should. So what I'm saying is, there was faith on the part of Isaac. The faith was that when God says someone is going to be blessed, he will be blessed. That's why the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant were worth stealing for, or cheating for, or deceiving for. And so although the faith is present, the manifestation of that faith is absolutely wrong. Can you believe that? You can do the wrong thing for the right reason. Men can sin on the basis of faith. Now, look at Rahab, verse 31 of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. People have always agonized. How in the world can Rahab be listed in the hall of faith when she lied? Same way Abraham, Isaac, and all the rest of them did. You see, she really did have faith in God. She believed that God had chosen that people. She believed in the Abrahamic covenant. Now, the manifestation of her faith was wrong, but her faith was real. And that says to me, folks, that is something we need to look out for. Faith does not automatically manifest itself in righteous deeds. Not automatically, as some of us might suppose. And that is why the Scriptures are so full of the balance of saying, practice what you preach. Practice your position. do what you believe. It is not just enough to believe. And that's why many of us are such terrible witnesses. We believe, and the world looks around and says, they do? The expressions of our faith.